voice.
Ukraine says at least 24 people have been killed and more than 80 have been wounded in a Russian ballistic missile strike on the northeastern city of Sumy. The city is around 30 miles from the Russian border. Our correspondent, James Waterhouse, who's in Kyiv, says President Zelensky's warning that Russia is preparing for a major spring offensive.
It is a familiar Russian tactic to target Ukrainian cities. You will hear the Kremlin, they will say, well, we are, you know, targeting military sites. But the evidence continues to mount to an overwhelming level that they are targeting cities, densely populated civilian areas. And this looks like an especially bad strike.
The business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, has defended the government's approach to saving British Steel's plant in Scunthorpe, saying it gives the opportunity to keep furnaces burning. Emergency legislation was passed in the Commons yesterday to give ministers control of management and workers. Mr. Reynolds told the BBC that using public funds already earmarked for the industry to save the plant was a sound economic decision. Two prison officers are still receiving treatment in hospital after an alleged attack by Hashim Abedi, one of the men responsible for the Manchester Arena bombing at Franklin Prison in County Durham. A third's been discharged. Counter-terrorism police are leading the investigation following reports that the officers had cooking oil thrown at them and were stabbed with homemade weapons. Israeli missiles have hit the only hospital still functioning in Gaza City. Medics at the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital say the intensive care unit and surgery department were destroyed. Israel says it was targeting a Hamas command centre there. The Home Office says 656 migrants crossed the Channel yesterday in 11 boats, the highest daily figure so far this year. It brings the total number of crossings for 2025 to more than 8,000 people. The winners of the boat races to be held between Oxford and Cambridge this afternoon have been warned not to throw their cocks into the water after concerning levels of E. coli were found in the Thames. The Minister for Water, Emma Hardy, said the level of pollution was completely unacceptable and promised government action to fix it. And the weather, a cooler and breezier day with variable clouds, scattered showers and sunny spells. Further rain will move into Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland later. BBC News. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Terry Gilliam is one of the world's most imaginative and original directors. He first made his mark more than 50 years ago with the animated opening sequence of Monty Python's Flying Circus, when a giant foot stomped on the titles with a burst of flatulence, Chaucerian in its way. That spirit of mischief, fun and creative adventure has informed many of his films. They include Time Bandits, Brazil, The Fisher King, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, working with stars like Matt Damon, Uma Thurman, Brad Pitt and Robin Williams. He'd be the first to admit that life as a filmmaker can be complicated. He's faced natural disasters, budget overruns and clashes with studio executives. But he has no plans to retire, I'm glad to say. Now in his 85th year, he's working on a new film called Carnival at the End of Days, starring Johnny Depp as Satan and Jeff Bridges as God. That sounds too good to be true. We'll come on to that. Terry, your original list of musical passions could easily have filled three or four programmes, so we've had to try and whittle it down. But we still have Richard Strauss, Berlioz, Delius, and we're going to start with Bernstein conducting the overture from Candide. Why this?
Oh, Candide is just a wonderful musical. I think what's intriguing about Bernstein, because he sort of introduced me to classical music with this television show for young people. And then when I saw the film Maestro recently, I thought, why are they not using all of his show tunes? They went for his Requiem and the great classic things, and they're not as good as his show tunes. He wanted to be seen as one of the great serious composers, as opposed to a great composer who wrote a different form of music. And I think it was very sad because he did introduce so many people, especially, I think, in my generation and younger, to classical music.
Well, he was wonderful at this sort of music, wasn't he? West Side Story absolves here, a classic. But Candide's pretty lively.
Oh, it was a failure on Broadway. But it is the most wonderful music. And Sondheim wrote the lyrics, which are absolutely stunning. And the cast is phenomenal. Nobody's done it better. And before he died, Bernstein re-recorded it with better singers, supposedly. It didn't have the life the original version has. It's so full of life and joy and hope, optimism, love, everything, all before the downfall of Candide.
Tell us a little bit about your early life, Terry. You grew up in Minnesota?
Yep, in the country. I'm a country boy. When I first arrived in England, I was referred to as a monosyllabic Minnesota farm boy. I didn't quite speak the language as it ought to be spoken, but being born and raised in the country is extraordinary. I mean, my father was a carpenter. He had taken this summer cottage in a lake outside of Minneapolis and weatherproofed it, basically, and made it fit for winters. We didn't have an indoor toilet till I was, I think, about 10. We had to go to the Biffy at the bottom of the garden. And when you're doing that in 40 degrees below zero in the winter, this is painful. But I have no childhood memory of how unpleasant that was. Childhood was a joy. Forest behind the house, a swamp across the street. It was wonderful.
Is that where your love of making things perhaps came from?
Oh, yeah. A carpenter, he makes things. He's a craftsman. Mm. And I think that's what I like doing, is making things, whether it's cartoons or opera or movies. That act is what it's about. I mean, the inspiration and the artistic bit is something, but it's the craft that I really admire.
And was there music in the house?
Not really. We had an old Victrola, and I think there was probably a Beethoven or something on occasionally. I did listen to radio nonstop, though, and radio had music on. There was the FBI in Peace and War, and of course the Lone Ranger was being played all the time.
Your films often have an element of someone trying to escape the confines of their life, and I wonder whether music does that for you too.
Oh, totally, yeah. It is one of the best escape routes I know, because you can fall into it, and because it isn't defined with words and measurements, you really escape from the banality of life. You can go into these other words. I think that's one reason a lot of the music I like is 19th century. It tends to be storytelling, a lot of it. And that's what I like. I can get lost in it.
And the circus, I think, sparked your imagination.
Oh, God. The Clyde Beatty Circus came to San Fernando Valley, where we're living at this point, and I got to work on pulling the tents up. All the kids would get paid a dollar or something. There was the alligator boy, the lizard man, the fat lady, all these extraordinary characters. It's like humanity can be anything, almost, you begin to believe. But having raised the tent, I was there sweeping up, and there they were just sitting around playing cards. They were just like you and me. And that, to me, was a great learning lesson. And I loved the fact that, you know, people that were extraordinary had a chance to actually make a living. Most people at that point, extraordinary, I mean by being deformed, disfigured, anything, were hidden away. But these people were out in a public space.
When you and I were young, Maggie Blues, now tell me about this. It's obviously very important to you.
Well, Cliff Edwards, or Ukulele Ike, is a very important character. When I was a kid, and still, one of my top 10 films is Pinocchio, Walt Disney's Pinocchio. And we have When You Wish Upon a Star, and you have Jiminy Cricket singing Give a Little Whistle. Those songs stay with me. They are what I fall back on when I really get depressed about life. And this wonderful voice of Cliff Edwards, Ukulele Ike, and I play it nonstop because he's got this incredible voice. It's beautiful. And the songs are from basically the 30s and the 40s, a time when there was, it always felt musically there was more innocence in the world. There's also a lot of naughtiness because Cliff Edwards, his songs are really on the edge, but his voice is so beautiful. And this particular one, the Maggie Blues one, is because my wife is Maggie, and it's a song about people getting old. And there we are. We were cast for the part for this song.
Say, I've been requested to sing an old-time song, something my granddaddy used to sing. But I'm afraid I'd make that old ditty sound all wrong. I'd fill it full of blues and everything. But I've got a little plan, and I'll do the best I can to sing an old song so you can all understand. You simply take a favorite, and then you flavor it with just a note or two of blue harmony. Tell the orchestra to play staccato, then you swing a little obbligato. Now the Maggie tune is a raggy tune. Pay no attention to the music that they play. Just rock your weary blues away. Start to sway. It's getting warm now. Say the broken time is in spoken time. All around the sea, harmony, charmony. Every loving note is a loving boat just full of music that you can't refuse. Now you know the way, tell the band to play, and when you listen, you christen it and say, I got those when you and I were young, Maggie Blues. Yes, I wander today through the hills, Maggie, to watch the scenes below. The creek and that creaking old mill, Maggie, just as we did long ago. Said the green grass is gone from the hill, Maggie, where once the daisies sprung. So let us sing of the days that are gone, Maggie, when you and I were young. Yes, now you know the way, tell the band to play, and when you listen, you christen it and say, I got those when you and I were young, Maggie Blue.
He's really wonderful. Great.
It's absolutely fantastic. His rhythm is incredible. He does this scat singing. With his lips, he plays instruments. And it's absolutely wonderful to see something that sort of full of life, because we don't get this kind of music anymore. And I don't know, I suppose this music came after the First World War. Things are getting better, and it's before it all starts falling apart again.
When you and I were young, Maggie Blues, Cliff Edwards. Terry, you moved to a neighborhood near Los Angeles and became president of your class and senior prom king, voted most likely to succeed. I don't know why I find all this funny talking to you, but I do sometimes. You got straight A's, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess education in America at that point wasn't very difficult.
Were you a bit of a geek at school?
Not at all. It was easy. I mean, the thing that I was happiest being was the head cheerleader. That was great fun. The other things like King of the City Prom, those were shocks to me because I was never interested in becoming like that. I liked being in front of a crowd, trying to get them riled up, making noise, shouting.
So were you popular?
Apparently.
Well, that's continued. Did you study art or was drawing something you just enjoyed at home?
I just drew since I was a kid. I just drew, and I'd have ideas. One of the things that I've kept, my drawings of turning household appliances into Martians.
And you went to university, and then you worked for a satirical magazine, Help. What sort of things were you doing there?
Well, Harvey Kurtzman was the guy who created Mad Comics, and he was like a god to all of us cartoonists, people interested in humor. And at college, I took the arts magazine into a humor magazine with a few friends, and we were copying a lot of things Harvey was doing. One of the things he did were fumetti, which is Italian for little puffs of smoke. So that's like a comic book with people speaking in those balloons, except it wasn't drawn. It was real people. So in many ways, it was like making a movie without movement. We had to have actors, we had to have sets, we had to have all those things. And I sent him our magazine, and he wrote a letter back saying, really interesting work. And I said, I want to come to New York. And he says, don't do it. Don't bother. There's no work or there's nothing. And of course, I went to New York and ended up being his assistant editor for 3 years.
When did you first meet John Cleese?
That was on my hunt for an actor to work for $15 a day in one of our fumettis. And we had written this piece about a man who falls in love with his daughter's Barbie doll. And I got John to be in it because he had come over with Graham Chapman, Bill Oddie, on the coattails of Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Jonathan Miller, and we became friends.
What prompted your move from the States to the UK?
Well, a year before, I'd hitchhiked around Europe for about 4 or 5 months, and I just fell in love with Europe. The castles were better than the ones at Disneyland. They were real. And I loved all the different civilizations, basically. So I had returned to America, met an English girl, and she wanted to come back to England. And I thought, why not? So I arrived here in 1967 at the height of London as the center of the universe.
Max Brook next.
I was on a plane flight a few years ago, and this was playing, and maybe it was the tiny little earphones, but there was something about the violin. It was so painful and emotional. I said, I gotta get this thing. It just ripped into me, I don't know.
Thank you.
Boy.
It's very imploring, isn't it?
Oh, it's like a human soul struggling to survive. And then when the orchestra comes in with that big boom, it's shocking, terrifying. It really, I can't even explain it. I just feel it's something so existential.
The Allegro Moderato from Max Brooks Violin Concerto No. 1 in G minor, performed by Randall Gusby, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nézet-Séguin. Terry Gilliam, how did you come to meet up with the other members of Monty Python?
Well, when I got to London, I was doing illustrations, and I was just getting tired of magazine work, and I saw John on television. I just thought, come on, there's got to be a way in there. And I said to John, could you introduce me to somebody? He gave me the name Humphrey Barclay, who was a producer. And it took me months to track Humphrey down. The phone was never answered. And when it was very difficult. I finally met him, and I was carrying my portfolio of cartoons and drawings, and he was sort of an amateur cartoonist, and he really loved those, and so he decided to bring me into the fold. And the fold was Did Not Adjust Your Set, a children's show starring, written by Terry Jones, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and that was it. I went down to meet them. Eric was the most friendly, because I had a very cool sheepskin coat that I'd painted, and he spotted somebody exotic, and he brought me in. There were these other two guys. It was a pub, and they were down in the back in the shadows there with their gnashing little teeth looking at me as if I was moving into their territory. They were rodental at that point. And it turned out to be Mike and Terry. And they started using my cartoons on the show, and that was the beginning of what was Python. I mean, I still find it kind of a miracle that this guy from the States ends up in England with Oxbridge graduates, and we seem to share the same sense of humor. I mean, mine was not verbal, it was visual. That's the difference. And it worked.
A love of the ridiculous.
Well, that was it, yeah. And the great thing was that foot, which actually exists in the National Gallery, a painting by Bronzino. And it's about lust. It's got a great porcelain Venus there being caressed on her breast by her son Cupid. And Cupid's foot is in the bottom left corner of the painting, about to crush two billion cooing doves. And that foot, I just thought, this is fantastic. And that's the foot, the Python foot, that crushes everything. I just thought the idea of love being the most dangerous thing in the show was very nice. It was the best times of my life because we had freedom. The BBC was sort of so laissez-faire about the way they dealt with things. And we got to do what we wanted to. There was nobody in charge except us.
Your first film as director was Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Terry, when you worked alongside Terry Jones. Had you had experience doing anything like that at that stage?
Well, in New York, I had managed to save enough money up to buy a Bolex 16mm camera, and I was living with two other guys. One was a cartoonist, the other was a writer. And on the weekends, we would go and shoot a short little film. Depending on what the weather was like, we would try to write something silly, and they were just silly silent movies. But that was my experience in filmmaking before Holy Grail.
But that also meant that you brought something fresh to the medium.
Well, I think I keep doing that because I'm naive. I don't know what I'm doing. And for whatever reason, I get the job. And off I go.
Your next piece is actually from a film about an Italian film director, isn't it?
Oh, this will be Fellini. Mm. One of the gods for me. I mean, his films were just extraordinary, the way he dealt with humanity, the way he shot. He began as a cartoonist as well. So this sense of humor, this sense of play, and this sense of grotesque is what cartooning is about, and that's what his films are about, and mine in a lesser way.
So presumably in 1963, it was 8.5 that got you.
Oh, God. I mean, when I saw that film, I said, that's what film directing is like. It's about tap dancing. And that's what Marcello Mastroianni is doing through most of that film, is tap dancing, because people are all coming to him for information, for advice, for direction, and he's not sure what he's doing. And I love the idea of a film that Fellini didn't know how to basically finish. That kind of boldness, I suppose, in not going down the straight and narrow road, seeing life in a different way. And I've always been that. I think every film I've made, I'm trying to encourage people to think other than the way they normally think, the way the media tells them to think. I just want people to start thinking for themselves wherever that may go.
And as we're going to hear, Nina Rota managed to bring lots of different worlds all kaleidoscopically together, didn't he, in this?
He's extraordinary because the music seems so light and easy, but it's so very clever, and it works so well in a contrapuntal way with what Fellini is doing visually. It's not like normal film music. It's its own world, and there's Fellini's world, and they somehow dance together. The tempo changing is so wonderful. It starts as the wonderful, joyous circus, which slowly goes madder and madder and madder. And then he, at the end, takes it down.
He kind of syncopates the rhythms, doesn't he?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So there's a kind of feeling of, like that.
It's just wondrous work.
The original soundtrack recording of La Passerella di Otto e Mezzo, composed and conducted by Nino Rota. Terry Gilliam, you wanted to make your own films, and you did. Time Bandits was one of the early ones, about a young boy escaping his suffocating parents and having an incredible adventure encountering icons like Napoleon Bonaparte, Robin Hood, and King Agamemnon. Was this your childlike wonder at the world beginning to find its way onto film?
I suppose so. I mean, I wanted to make it from a child's point of view. That was how it began. And then I wanted to surround him with adults who were the same size as him, if not even smaller. And that's how it developed. And I like him going out and meeting his heroes and discovering they're not so heroic. And I thought, this is a good education film for kids. The world is not the way it's normally sold to you. And to me, it was wondrous because to get Kenny Baker, he was one of the Time Bandits, get him out of an R2-D2 tin can and become a real actor on the screen was very important, to give those guys a chance, because I wanted to show them that they were leading men. They weren't just guys in womble suits or playing pantomime characters. They were real actors. And that was important.
Time Bandits was an incredible financial success, actually.
Yeah.
I wondered if that opened the gates for you to have an element of carte blanche with the film Brazil, starring Jonathan Pryce.
What happened with Time Bandits, all the studios passed the script down, they passed the finished film down, and we had, at that point, started handmade films. It was George Harrison. And the film went out, and it went to number one. It sat there for weeks. And so I was this golden boy in Hollywood, who is this exotic foreigner, a guy who was grown up next door to Hollywood. But they didn't know what to make. And so people come to you when you become successful. And I met a producer named Arnon Milchan, who had just made Once Upon a Time in America with Sergio Leone. And we liked each other, and off we went. We were like two kids in Cannes, running around the festival, trying to con people into giving us the money. And he actually managed to get two studios involved, 20th Century Fox and Universal. The story goes on, as it gets very ugly, but it starts well.
Brazil really explores the borderline, doesn't it, between imagination and reality.
Very much. I mean, it's a guy working in a bureaucracy who has these wonderful dreams, flying, you know, beautiful girl, everything. It's all that. What the film is really about is lack of responsibility. People don't recognize that. He avoided being moved up the chain. He stayed low down so he could have his dreams and not the responsibility. In the end, he pays the price.
The studio heads were rather less than enthusiastic, weren't they? You had to find, I'm being polite here, you had to find a way to get this film out.
Yeah, well, the studio, when they saw it, hated it, basically. Then the battle began, and luckily there was a man named Jack Matthews. He was film writer for the Los Angeles Times, and he became this person in the middle between me and the studios, because he would interview me, and I would say things about the studio and about Sid Sheinberg, who was the head of production. And he would then go and talk to Sid, and then Sid would respond. And Sid and I weren't meeting at all, because they had banned the film. I took an ad out in Variety, and I just bordered it in black and left it all blank except for written in a small, personal way, "Dear Sid Sheinberg, when are you going to release my film, Brazil, signed Terry Gilliam?" Mm. Nobody had done things like that before, because it's a stupid thing to do. Mm. But naivete won the day eventually.
Unhappy endings are common in your films, and I wonder if that's because you rather hate the idea of neatly tying up loose ends.
Yeah, I want to leave it so there's room for the audience to end the film the way they want to, or at least leaving a question. I want everybody who leaves the cinema after seeing one of my films to have a different idea of what they just saw. And that's what music is like. It doesn't tell you how to appreciate it, how to enjoy it, how to respond to it. It does the work. And you're just dragged along.
Well, the next piece is by Delius, Over the Hills and Far Away, which sounds like a Hollywood film, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I only discovered Delius thanks to Ken Russell.
Ken Russell.
And his television shows. It's so pastoral. It's like my childhood, I could argue. It's soft, it's floating, it's beautiful, and it's a nice thing to go to sleep listening to.
Well, don't go to sleep just yet. We'll play it.
It's so beautiful. I used to play the French horn in high school. I love that instrument. It's so almost unearthly because it floats out there. It doesn't sit on the ground. It just floats in space. Listening to that Delius again there, I thought, here's this beautiful pastoral world, the sun setting its glory, and then the mosquitoes and the gnats come out, and you're banging, ah, and by the end, you suddenly jump in the water, boom! It's a stunning bit of work. It relaxes you, it eases you in, and then it hammers you.
Over the Hills and Far Away, composed by Frederick Delius and performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the film director, Terry Gilliam. Terry, you've mentioned opera, and you've directed two, both by Berlioz. I wonder how very different the experience of working in an opera house must be.
Well, I was lucky because it was the ENO, and they're based at the Colosseum. And the Colosseum, luckily, was an old music hall. And so it took away the weight of opera, because I had never done opera. I had only seen one or two operas in my life. And it was Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, which was never actually written as an opera originally. It was eight symphonic pieces that he cobbled together and suddenly had the tale of Faust and Mephistopheles. And I, for whatever reason, just made this quantum leap into German history in the 20th century, because musically it starts in the beautiful end of 19th century mountains of Germany. And then my brain just started dancing with this music. And suddenly I've got the First World War. And then we get into the Weimar Republic, where from all the beautiful natural world, it comes into this expressionistic world where the colors are changing, harsh. And then it moves into that nice symmetrical world of Nazism with a nice symmetrical swastika. And you've got just red and white and black. And I was introduced to Leah Hausman. She was at that point called a movement director, and we just became a team and ended up doing two operas together because she had the kind of skills and knowledge that I didn't, and I had the imagination that wasn't trapped in the world of opera.
So how did you approach things like casting?
Well, this was the problem. The singers are hired well in advance. And I didn't like any of them. I didn't think, well, they had beautiful voices, but they couldn't act. I just wanted actors. And I only got our Faust a month before we started rehearsals, Peter Hoare. And off we went, and it worked. Apparently, it was the biggest success of the year for them. What I loved the most was 41% of the audience had never been to the opera before. They were coming to see this ex-Python. What kind of mess is he going to create?
Well, it was such a success that they asked you to do a second opera, Benvenuto Cellini.
Well, Cellini is a character that I've always been intrigued with. He's the only Renaissance artist to write his own autobiography. It's an incredibly wonderful read because he's so outrageous. He's such an egomaniac. He gets himself in trouble all the time. I identified with him.
Edward Gardner was the conductor. And that creates quite a tussle, doesn't it? Or can do, between a director and a conductor.
Well, he directed Faust first, so we got on at the beginning. He just had no idea what I was about. By the end of that, we ended up very, very close, I thought. And it came to Cellini. And one of the problems, most of this work has to be translated into English. Now, there was one sequence when Cellini's workers, who are gold workers, they're making jewelry and things. They have this great song, and it had been translated in English as, "Honor, honor to the master goldsmiths." That is not musical. That is not. And I got Charles Hart, who's a great lyricist, to come up with a decent translation. So it was, "Laud and applaud the arts and artisans." I thought, wow, it's musical, it's great. So we're doing this scene, and the workers have just been paid. They got money. And I added some courtesans, some whores that turn up to get the money before the workers give it to their wives. And I wanted to change our new translated lyrics into something more appropriate. So rather, "Laud and applaud the arts and artisans, laud and applaud the tarts and courtesans." It made sense. And Ed and I got in a huge fight about it. He said, "You can't change it." I said, "We've already changed the lyric from what they were originally to something good, and this is appropriate." And he actually said he was there to curate an opera. And I said, no, we're trying to create an opera. There's a difference, Ed.
Yes, you had various tussles about wanting to cut bits and pieces, didn't you?
I mean, we cut Shakespeare. Why can't we cut opera, is my attitude. I felt very strongly, I want to make this stuff work for a modern audience. It was written for a different world, different ways of thinking. So if you can do it and get a modern audience in there and involved, it's great.
Well, let's hear scenes 10 and 11 from the first act.
Great. This is the bit, actually, when Cellini's assistant brings in the money from the Pope to pay the workers.
Come on.
Wow.
Music from the opera Benvenuto Cellini by Berlioz, performed by the London Symphony Choir and Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Terry Gilliam, your filmmaking experiences, let's put it this way, have never been quite straightforward, have they?
The straight and narrow path has never been mine.
Let's take The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. A little bit over budget?
Oh, I don't even know what it ended up costing, because we had $23.5 million from the studio. And the producer fired, I think, four or five accountants who wouldn't come up with a budget that matched the $23.5 million. The movie was closed down by the bond company, the insurance company, and they were trying to force me to not let the Baron go to the moon. That's a very key adventure in the whole thing, because my moon sequence involved 2,000 people, all with heads that came off, separated from their body during an eclipse, and then those heads and bodies never got back to the right combinations. The king of the moon was Sean Connery, and when they said he can't go to the moon, I basically chopped off three zeros from the 2,000 and had two people on the moon, the king and the queen. And Sean said, you know, I really don't want to be king of just my wife. And so he was off. And luckily, Eric Idle was a good friend of Robin Williams and said, maybe Robin will come on board. And Robin did come on board. And Robin was absolutely wonderful. I took the drawings for the sets and blew them up so they're about a meter high and put them on plywood, colored them in with felt tip markers, and we slid these buildings back and forth across to each other for the entrance to the moon. And it's better than what the original was going to be, I think, because it was a real quantum leap almost into the world of Adam Age for a brief moment.
That's interesting, isn't it? So often in art, limitation makes creation.
I mean, I hate it, because I really go crazy when suddenly says you can't. I'm like a spoiled brat. But I seem to get so much adrenaline racing through my body in rage that I come up with a fresh idea, which is often more interesting.
Well, you have a huge responsibility, don't you, when you're directing a film with complex sets, camera effects, actors, crew? And does that weigh on you? Do you sometimes think, oh my God, how are we going to deal with this?
No, I like all those people because I'm careful about who I work with. I want to work with really good people. And my responsibility, I think, is to get them to do better work than they're capable of, or they think they're capable of.
And have you ever felt that things went too far, that were completely beyond your control?
I don't think so. I think I've always managed to. I think I only get through it because I'm not the only guy making a movie. I'm the one that gets the credit. If it works, I get the blame if it's bad. But it's a teamwork, and that's why I enjoy making movies. I just love working with people with various talents.
And then, of course, there are other things which must be awful to have to deal with. I was thinking particularly of the tragic death of Heath Ledger during the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
That was really a killer. Because Heath was so wonderful. I mean, in many ways, he was like a son. He was that much younger, but he was also a very old spirit. There was something extraordinarily wonderful about Heath. And for him to die in the middle of the shooting of Dr. Parnassus was unbearable. I was in the art department trying to save $15,000 on something. And my daughter came in, you've got to come into the office. I said, I'm busy. Come in. And there it was on the BBC, Heath Ledger dead. And I just collapsed. I didn't know what to do. And basically, I gave up. I said, that's it. The film is over. There's no way. There's no other actor that can do what Heath could do. And my daughter and my cinematographer, Nicola, just wouldn't let me go. They just kept hammering me. We have got to make this movie. And one day I thought, well, the only way is to get three actors to play Heath. And my daughter said, call Johnny Depp. Because I had introduced him to Heath and they had become very close. And I called Johnny and he said, whatever you want, I'm there. And that stopped the retreat of all the money people.
Yeah.
I mean, the film was dead. Mm. Everybody had left. So they all came back. And then I got Jude Law and Colin Farrell to come in and do it. And these were all friends of Heath, people that knew him doing it. And we finished the film.
It's nice to hear that they so wanted to pay tribute to their friend.
And they worked for nothing. All the money that they would have been paid went to Heath's daughter. And that's the good side of Hollywood. I mean, most actors, they really care about each other, however competitive they may be.
Now, Terry Gilliam, you are, I think, a man of many pranks, if I may put it that way. And so it's not surprising that you've included Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel.
Oh, yeah. Till Eulenspiegel is just so funny. A little troublemaker. And I identify with him.
Thank you.
In my head, I'm watching a movie of it as this music plays. Oh, and there's the set, there's this, he's doing that.
Till Eulenspiegel by Richard Strauss, performed by the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Antal Durati. In 2014, you and the Monty Python team staged a much-anticipated reunion, sadly, of course, without Graham Chapman, who had died some years earlier. Are you glad you did that, looking back on it?
I'm glad looking back, and I'm glad when we did it. I was against it because I thought it would not be us at our best, especially without Graham there. And so I was fairly negative, and I was also doing one of the operas at the same time. But we did it, and it was fantastic. It was great fun being back together again. And I had to fill in the gaps that were there. And I'm not that great a performer compared to the others. But it was good fun because the audience was so much on our side, you got to almost do anything and get away with it.
We're going to hear next music from Respighi, the Ancient Airs and Dances.
This is an odd one because I don't know why I got this particular album. It's von Karajan conducting Respighi's antique dances. And there's one in particular. When I first heard it, I thought, wow, this is strange. And I've heard the way it's normally performed, which is a good stately dance with a thump, 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 thump. It goes very nicely. Yes. Von Karajan takes the tempo way down. It's slow. It starts with energy and then it's weight. It's the weight of being a peasant. Everything is oppressing you and you still have to keep marching on through the mud, and then you get a little bit stronger and you almost make it. It has nothing to do with dancing. It really struck me, and I play it a lot because I find it powerful. It's the life of somebody with so many difficulties who fights on, survives, and maybe not succeeds, but ends with a bit of a flourish.
Thank you.
unbelievably powerful, I find that. This is not a dance for the rich. All I can see is peasants. I can see this lowering sky, the mud up to, and it's just hard work to get through this life. And he does.
We heard the Passacaglia from the suite number 3 of Ottorino Respighi's Ancient Airs and Dances, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Terry Gilliam, so many of the magical effects used in your films rely wonderfully on handcrafted work and analogue illusions. So I wonder what you make of the advent of CGI techniques. Do you feel we're in danger of losing something?
There's something lost, definitely. Gravity, most of all. Because just because you can do anything with CG, why should you? So I like using maquettes and physical things because light affects them in a different way. I don't want to reject nature completely. In fact, most people don't really understand nature. They're fighting against nature. We as human beings seem to be determined to oppress nature. And it's the hubris involved in humanity that I don't like. And so there's something about maquettes and actual things that keep me in touch with nature.
Well, Terry, as anyone listening to this program will have realized, you're full of beans as you turn 85. Tell me about the latest film starring Johnny Depp and Jeff Bridges called Carnival at the End of Days. What's it about?
It's about God finally giving up on humanity and deciding to wipe it out because of them buggering up his beautiful garden. And there's only one character in the whole piece that's trying to save humanity, and that's Satan. Because without humanity, he's out of a job for eternity. And so he's trying to find a new Adam and Eve and convince God it's worth starting again. He does let God wipe out humanity, but we start again with a clean slate.
This has an almost Python-esque conversation emerging here. Do you believe in God?
I don't know what I believe in. I think I believe in the cosmos. I believe in nature. I believe things are out there. There's nobody I can pray to that'll come to my rescue. I've always said in the past, the only God I really believe in is the God of irony. Because it seems to be the force that's consistent in my life, if not anybody else's.
Well, let's have your final piece, rather sadly. We could go on for a long time.
Not at my age.
So what are we going to hear?
Ever since working on Brothers Grimm in Prague, I've become more and more in love with gypsy music, whether it's Hungarian, Romanian, it doesn't matter. And Andodram is one of the groups. I just love the music, and in particularly the woman's voice. She's a great singer. But this is full of life and energy.
Well, on that note, thank you very much indeed, Terry Gilliam.
Thank you.
Shama ваша лапа, ваша курдеша бура. Думая бой палала, ваша лапа, ваша ма, ваша лапа, ваша курдеша бура. Алома, 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 ла-ла-ла-ла, да-ла-ла-ла. Алома, лома, талома, алома, лома, талома. Алома, лома, талома, лома, лома. Алома, лома, талома.
Satella Jarve, performed by Ando Drom, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Terry Gilliam. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And this coming Tuesday, Private Passions celebrates its 30th birthday. And throughout the day here on Radio 3, we'll be sharing some of the most memorable moments from across the decades with guests including David Attenborough, Brian Cox, Joan Armatrading, Dudley Moore, Dame Edna Everidge, and many more. That's coming up this Tuesday, the 15th of April, all day here on BBC Radio 3. A string quartet that started out as a piano sonata. We're off on a musical journey towards the music of Fanny Mendelssohn next.
BBC Radio 3, the home of live classical music.
The audience loving this performance, lots of them on their feet.
From unique performances across the UK.
Fantastic. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, it's just spectacular.
To our lunchtime concerts from Wigmore Hall. And marvellous Saturday night opera.
Incredible live music, all year round.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
At 3 o'clock this afternoon, choral evensong comes from St Matthew's Church in Westminster in London. But first, here on BBC Radio 3 at 1:30, it's time to join Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we take a single piece of classical music and make our way towards it through a landscape of connected sounds. And today, we're heading for this destination. This is the E-flat major string quartet by Fanny Mendelssohn, a composer who was both celebrated as a child prodigy and also somewhat crushed by the patriarchy, not to mention overshadowed by her brother, the more famous Felix. There was a moment towards the end of their lives where their relationship cooled a bit, but for the most part, Felix and Fanny were great siblings, firm friends, and each other's musical soulmates. So let's begin with one of Felix's most famous chamber works for strings, his octet. Thank you.
Thank you.